Many international aid groups have closed their doors in Afghanistan. Those who remain are calling for swift action.
Somebody say that it's on the brink of catastrophe. It is a catastrophe.
I'm Carol Hills. Canadian elections are on Monday. Every major party has a climate plan, thanks in part to this summer's heat wave and wildfires.
I didn't really wear N95s throughout the pandemic. I was wearing an N95. It was that yellow, acrid smoke.
And there's a new milk option at a coffee shop in Nairobi.
We're trying to create a camel coffee scene here in Kenya, and hopefully that can scale to the rest of the world.
Also today, we get the skinny on the new security pact that's anchored China and annoyed some key U.S. allies, too. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. President Biden has reached a new security pact for the Asia-Pacific region. He made the announcement in a joint virtual appearance with the prime ministers of Australia and the United Kingdom.
We all recognize the imperative of ensuring peace and stability in the Indo-Pacific over the long term.
The new security arrangement has a nickname, AUKUS. That's short for Australia, UK, and US.
AUKUS will bring together our sailors, our scientists, and our industries to maintain and expand our edge in military capabilities and critical technologies such as cyber, artificial intelligence, quantum technologies, and undersea domains.
Biden and his counterparts from Australia and the UK never mentioned China by name, but as The World's Matthew Bell reports, they didn't have to.
Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison said this new trilateral security partnership is aimed at bringing stability to a complex and vital region.
The future of the Indo-Pacific will impact all our futures. To meet these challenges, to help deliver the security and stability our region needs, we must now take our partnership to a new level.
Under the terms of this deal, Australia will join a small handful of nations that have nuclear-powered submarines. The U.S. will be sharing that technology only for the second time since 1958, when it started doing so with Britain. Nuclear-powered subs are costly and complicated, though, and it could be up to a decade before Australia's Navy actually puts one into the Pacific. In the meantime, this security pact sends a message to China.
The United States National Security Strategy and the Biden administration's interim security strategy have clearly identified China as the primary threat to the United States.
Zachary Abuza is a professor at the Naval War College. He says this security deal won't actually change military capabilities in the Asia-Pacific all that much, especially in the short term, because Australia was already planning to upgrade its submarine fleet even before this pact was announced.
But what it really does is it anchors the United States to Asia-Pacific security.
So is this the long-talked-about American pivot to Asia? Absolutely not, experts say. But it is a significant shift for Australia, whose economy is closely tied with China's. Because of that, the Australian government has long sought to maintain good relations with China. But Zachary Abuza says in recent years, Beijing has taken an aggressive approach.
China has launched an all-out trade war against Australia, limiting the import of iron ore, wool, red wine. We've seen intense Chinese political interference in Australia, really trying to influence the social media there. Much of the same thing that the Russians do in the United States, the Chinese do in Australia.
Beijing says the new AUKUS security pact seriously undermines regional peace and stability and intensifies the arms race and represents Cold War thinking. But the Chinese government can't be all that surprised, says Taylor Fravel. He's the director of the Security Studies Program at MIT.
This happened a decade ago. I think it would have been a much bigger deal. But I think the two countries in some ways are in a standoff over what the terms of their future relationship should be.
Both Beijing and Washington talk about the need to avoid an all-out confrontation, Fravel says, but neither appears willing to break the momentum to change the downward trajectory in the U.S.-China relationship. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
The new alliance isn't just bugging China. France's nose is also way out of joint. Former French ambassador to Washington, Gérard Araud, tweeted last night, The world is a jungle. France has just been reminded of this bitter truth by the way the U.S. and the U.K. have stabbed her in the back in Australia. Our Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, has been following events from London, and she joins us now. So, Orla, are the French just mad that they weren't invited to the club?
Well, that would be part of it, but mainly it's because they've lost a huge contract with Australia. So they had signed this deal with Australia back in 2016 to build submarines, to build diesel submarines. And it's reported to have been worth around $90 billion to France. So not an inconsiderable sum for them. So with Australia signing up to this alliance, now that deal is dead in the water. And the French have been very vocal about the position today. The French Foreign Minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, was on TV this morning.
C'est vraiment en bon français un coup dans le dos. Nous avions établi avec l'Australie une relation de confiance.
And he said this is really a stab in the back. We had built a relationship of trust with Australia and that trust is now betrayed. He said, I'm really, really angry at this and there's a lot of bitterness about this breach of contract. And interestingly, he went on to say, Carl, what also concerns him is the behaviour of the Americans, what he described as this unilateral, abrupt decision. He said, this is something like Mr. Trump would have done. And the TV presenter then asked him if he felt he was being scammed by America and by the Americans. And he said, yes.
Wow. And I understand France isn't just annoyed with the Americans and Australians. They're also unhappy with Britain's role in all of this.
Yeah, you know, as you pointed out, the former French ambassador accused both the US and the UK of stabbing France in the back. And the British government is more than aware that they've irritated the French, even though today they have been at pains to play it all down. You had the British Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace, on TV this morning talking up the relationship between the two countries.
We have no intention of doing anything to antagonise the French. The French are some of our closest military allies in Europe. We are sizable and comparable forces, and we do things together.
And then this afternoon, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson was in Parliament saying that Britain and France stand shoulder to shoulder together and the relationship between the two countries is rock solid. But the reality, of course, is that the relationship between the two has been under considerable strain for some time. We have continuing problems with Brexit, which has caused food shortages and other issues on both sides of the channel because of all the additional paperwork and the red tape involved, etc. So this has really exacerbated tensions between the two. And obviously, this latest alliance doesn't help matters.
What about the European Union? I mean, what is its role in all of this? I imagine it feels somewhat put out that it's not included.
Indeed, EU leaders, I imagine, are not too happy with this. By the way, the timing couldn't be worse in some ways for the EU because today it was scheduled to lay out its own Indo-Pacific strategy. But also, it must be pretty irritating for the EU that the European partner the US decides to form an alliance with should be Brexit Britain, you know, the one that's already left the Union.
Hmm. And of course, the whole new AUKUS agreement has China very much in mind, even though it doesn't say that. And today in Britain, there was a cabinet reshuffle underway and a new foreign secretary has been appointed. How is that likely to impact the UK's future relationship with China?
Yeah, Liz Truss, she's the new foreign secretary. Dominic Raab is out of office. And she has been quoted in the past as saying the world needs to get tough on China. So it will be interesting to see what happens. I mean, Boris Johnson, I guess, for his part, has always tried to tread a fairly careful path with China. But he has a number of very vocal MPs in the party who have been for a long time saying that the UK needs to take a stronger line with China, in particular in relation to human rights. And by the way, just yesterday, we saw the Chinese ambassador to the UK being told he was no longer welcome in Parliament because of sanctions China has imposed on a number of MPs recently.
The world's Orla Barry in London. Thanks a lot, Orla.
You're welcome, Carl.
The two South Pacific territories of French Polynesia and New Caledonia have experienced a surge in coronavirus cases lately. Until recently, the island states had escaped the worst of the pandemic. They're French territories, and the surge prompted Paris last week to extend a health emergency declaration through mid-November. That allows France to control the territory's borders, curfews, and quarantine rules. As Ashley Westerman reports, the situation has tested the relationship between the territories and Paris.
Trying to reach Dr. Jean-Paul Theron over the last week has been difficult. He was always unable to talk because he was working. When I did finally reach him, he was busy. bustling about the makeshift hospital in the small town of Paea on French Polynesia's main island of Tahiti.
I'm checking a problem of a bottle of oxygen.
Therone, a general practitioner with over four decades of experience, paints a dire picture of the COVID situation in French Polynesia, which has a population of some 280,000. Most of their nearly 600 deaths throughout the whole pandemic have occurred in the last 2 months.
It's horrible here. It's hell. It's permanently hell.
COVID-19 cases there have more than doubled since mid-July, which Therone notes came on the heels of a trip by French President Emmanuel Macron back in June.
I was sure that if we close the country, everything would be all right. If we leave the country open, we would have the big, big explosion. So now we have a huge epidemic with Delta.
Therone says he's watching some 80 COVID patients right now, most of whom are elderly. With the few hospitals in French Polynesia practically full, he cares for some patients outside of the hospital, and some of them via telemedicine. French Polynesia is, after all, a territory made up of 118 islands and atolls spread across a swath of the Pacific the size of Eastern Europe. And while Paris has sent aid, many doctors and officials say it's just not enough.
We are still the overseas territory with the worst case of pandemic here. We are far from receiving the same amount of aid than the French Antilles or Guyane or, you know, other territories.
That's Muay Thai Brotherson. He's a representative of French Polynesia in the French Parliament. He says Paris has only sent some 120 medical personnel there when they've sent hundreds to the French Caribbean. Brotherson, who caught COVID last year, says France has ignored his territory's pleas for more nurses and doctors and more equipment like oxygen. He has a theory.
Well, to put it bluntly, there are upcoming presidential elections for President Macron next year, and the potential voters is far greater in the French Antilles and in Guyane and in Réunion than in French Polynesia.
Meanwhile, he says confusing messages from Paris about masks and vaccines have fueled vaccine hesitancy and fake news.
So defiance has set up.
Though there is some vaccine hesitancy, nearly 40% of French Polynesia's population have received vaccines, all of which have come from France. Ziad Gibran is a press officer with France's Ministry of the Overseas. He says every territory is different. In Martinique and Guadeloupe, for example, France is responsible for health services.
And you have the Pacific territories, the Caledonia and Polynesia, where it's not our competence.
Just this month, New Caledonia, which lies nearly 3,000 miles west of French Polynesia, went from having less than 100 cases to over 1,300 cases. The territory also now has at least four deaths. Between the two, Gibran says France has given over $450,000 in state loans to help with the pandemic and economic rebound. In French Polynesia, Gibran says they're trying to balance the pandemic with the territory's tourism-dependent economy.
We're opening the borders because local authorities asked for it. And when we opened the borders and we saw that COVID was circulating, we asked the local government to confine earlier, but they decided to wait because they needed to have tourists and to have economic growth.
Still, it's estimated the territory lost some $1.2 billion in tourism revenue in 2020. For now, health officials say French Polynesia's COVID-19 cases have plateaued, but Dr. Jean-Paul Therone predicts cases won't actually start to decline for another 2 or 3 weeks. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. Pope Francis wrapped up a four-day visit to Hungary and Slovakia today. During his trip, the Roman Catholic pontiff warned against the dangers of closing borders and politicizing Christianity. Inez San Martin is a reporter with Crux, an independent Catholic news site. Inez, you've been following the Pope's trip. Why did he visit Hungary and Slovakia?
He visited Hungary because he wanted to take part in what is the International Eucharistic Congress, which is a big Catholic event that takes place in different cities every 2 or 3 years, and it has been happening for the past 150 years. He was the first pope since John Paul II in the year 2000 to take part. And what he told us is that Hungary was the door opening for him to go to Slovakia. He told us journalists about wanting to go to Slovakia several times on the road. And this was him finally fulfilling that promise.
How was the Pope received in both countries?
Very well. Actually, I have to acknowledge a little bit better than even what I had expected, particularly in Hungary, where there is this idea of a conservative Catholicism or Christianity that clashes with the Pope. However, we saw over 100,000 people attending the Mass that Pope Francis celebrated on Sunday in Budapest. His message resonated with most of the people there, and he was smart enough to focus on what he was actually there to do, which is talk about the Eucharist and try to not politicize the trip as much as possible.
You mentioned the Pope warning about politicizing Christianity. What does he mean by that? What did he say about that?
He was very specifically talking about the dangers of politicizing the cross. He raised against the dangers of using that as a political element, something that we have seen in Europe quite often as of late with populist leaders such as Matteo Salvini from Italy and Viktor Orban from Hungary, both of whom used the cross to justify their anti-immigration, anti-Muslim rhetoric, something that Pope Francis is actively against of.
Now, the Pope also made headlines on this trip when he said that priests should not refuse to give communion to politicians who support abortion rights. Now, President Biden is a devout Catholic who supports abortion rights, and some have argued that he should not be given communion. What exactly did Pope Francis say about this?
Pope Francis didn't actually come out and say that he would deny communion. He gave a very nuanced response to the matter of giving communion to people such as the U.S. president. He flat out refused to talk specifically about the case of the United States, but he did, however, acknowledge that he himself had never denied communion to anyone. He did, again, it was a very nuanced and long response to a very specific question. He did say that abortion is a murder, and when it comes to the Catholic Church, the teaching on this is very clear, and it's not bound to change. He also said, however, that when it comes to politicians, abortion, and communion, it should be dealt in a pastoral way, meaning in private, between the pastor and the person involved. It's not a matter of open discussion.
Pope Francis had surgery in July. How did his health seem to be holding up on this trip?
A lot better than we had all anticipated. We were expecting to see a man tired, still in recovering, because that's what he said not 2 weeks ago, talking to a group of Catholic businessmen. However, we saw a man ready to keep going and most often not ready to slow down, which was very, very interesting.
What had his health issue been?
He had a major colon surgery on July 4th. He had 13 inches or 33 centimeters of his intestines removed. And we know he's still on medication, and we know he's still doing physical therapy to recover from his surgery. However, again, he's seen in perfect health. I have to say, even healthier than I was at the end of the trip.
Inez San Martin is a reporter with Crux, an independent Catholic news site. She's been following Pope Francis's travels through Europe. Thanks a lot, Inez.
Thank you.
The dairy aisle of supermarkets show how expansive our appetite has become for all kinds of milk, full fat, no fat, almond, oat, soy, even hemp milk. But in Kenya, the next big thing is camel milk. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi has the story.
The Kulon Cafe in Nairobi's Eastleigh neighborhood is a popular spot. People come here for coffee, tea, and a mix of Somali and continental food. But when you look at the menu, a few things stand out.
We have a camel milk-based coffee drinks that we serve here. Similarly to how in other places of the world, like in the U.S., there's a new trend of oat milk coffee. We're trying to create a camel coffee scene here in Kenya, and hopefully that can scale to the rest of the world.
That's Bashir Wasame. He's a 27-year-old entrepreneur and one of the owners of the cafe. He spent most of his life in the United States, but his family hails from Somalia, where, like many pastoralist societies, camel milk and camel meat, for that matter, are common fare.
Camels is very iconic to the Somali culture, so just being around the nostalgia of these traditional products, it's something that made me want to learn. I wanted to learn more about it.
When Warsame went into business, he wanted to experiment with camel products and, if he could, help make them trendy. At the cafe, you can get camel meatballs, camel quesadillas, and camel cappuccinos, which I tried. It has a bit of a smoky taste to it. Warsame explains why.
It is smoked because it provides a natural way to increase the shelf life of the milk. So it changes the taste profile of the milk.
Warsame says smoking camel milk is the old school way of doing things. He knows that taste isn't for everyone. So a few years ago, he created Nug, a company that sells pasteurized camel milk and flavored camel yogurt. It's part of a bigger trend here in Kenya, says Khalif Abdulrahman Abe. He heads the Kenya Camel Association.
There's a lot of increase of the demand of the camel product, and in particular camel meat and milk.
Abi has been lobbying on behalf of camel producers for years. He estimates there are more than 3 million camels in Kenya, mostly in the north. But it was only a decade ago that Kenya officially designated the camel as a livestock animal. Now, Abi is pitching camel products as a sustainable option, too.
Camel, in the first place, is an answer to climate change. And camel is, it takes not like any other animal, the water intake. The same with also the pasture, because it's not competing with the cattle or the sheep and goat. It's not competing.
Arid parts of Kenya often suffer with seasonal drought. That can kill cattle and lead to famine. But camels are resilient, says Abe. They can go up to 15 days without water. He says for that reason, he's seeing more and more communities raising camels. And in turn, those communities are pitching the milk and meat as nutritious and healthy options for consumers. I visit a grocery chain in Nairobi. In the refrigerated section, I see countless options, from multiple brands of camel milk to goat and cow milk, too. Hamida Rashid is a mother of two, here evaluating her options. I ask her how she decides what to give her family.
To be honest, for me, the most important thing is nutrition. You know, how much nutrient are they getting from the milk that they actually take in?
She says her 3-year-old daughter is allergic to cow milk, so she's been exploring alternatives. She heard camel milk is low on lactose and super nutritious, but she says there's one thing her kids can't get over.
But they've tried camel milk here and there. Yes, it's really, really good. It's just that they can't really stand the smell of it. That's about it.
Even the pasteurized stuff has a distinct smell and taste to it. I asked Bashir Warsame from Kulon Cafe how he plans to convince reluctant or first-time customers, especially when the domestic market here in Kenya is his priority.
So whatever is your drink of choice, whether it's a chai latte or a caramel macchiato, I would just say add camel to that.
Or, as Warsame likes to say, camelize it. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
You're listening to The World. Pop star Lorde is singing in the Maori language. Five songs from her latest album, which was just released. It's earning her praise and criticism.
Do we need celebrity awareness for a language to survive?
Hear the music for yourself, coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World, a co-production of GBH and PRX. With the Taliban in control of Afghanistan, international humanitarian groups are gingerly finding their footing. Only a few aid groups still have their doors open in Kabul. Astrid Sletten heads one of those offices. She's the Norwegian Refugee Council's country director, and she's in Kabul. Astrid, what's your situation at the moment? I mean, are you able to go to your office, get in your car, and drive around town and meet with people, or is that just not feasible right now?
The situation is actually not bad. In fact, it's back to where it were a few weeks before Kabul fell, meaning traffic is still horrible and all the shops are open, perhaps with an exception of few beauty shops or fashion shops. And people are going about their business as usual in town. However, the mood is very somber, because a lot of people are asking themselves, you know, what is life going to be like in this new Afghanistan? People are allowed to take out only $200 from their bank account, no matter how much they have on their account, and only once a week. And the queues are like kilometer long.
How about your Afghan colleagues, male or female? Do they feel safe coming to work?
Well, all Afghan male and female staff are coming back to work in the office in Kabul. We may have a couple who are staying at home because their families are not comfortable, but like 98% are back in the office. And we have reopened our field offices in the Kabul informal settlements, meaning where all the IDPs are living in the outskirts of the city.
And IDPs are internally displaced persons.
We have been able to reopen schools in some areas, and there are still areas where Taliban is not allowing our female staff to resume work. And without our female staff, we refuse to open offices and we refuse to resume activities.
We've heard that the offices of some international NGOs have been broken into and trashed and their supplies stolen. How concerned are you about that?
Well, that is very concerning. However, Taliban is reassuring the NGO community that these are criminal elements and that they are in process of getting their functions in place. The Taliban police are even saying to us that even for them, this quick takeover was a surprise. They were expecting a more orderly handover. So they have needed a few weeks to get sorted things out. Yesterday, the chief of the Taliban police told NGOs he was meeting that they even have repossessed some vehicles that criminal elements had stolen that they realized belonged to NGOs. And they have asked NGOs that if you're missing a vehicle, call this number and we will sort it out and return the vehicles to you. So there's mixed messages.
You mentioned Taliban police. Do you and your staffers interact with Taliban officials and foot soldiers on a daily basis?
We see the foot soldiers driving through town. And yes, I do drive through town and I go to and from the office. And I even go to field locations in Kabul where we have services for internally displaced people. But yesterday we had a meeting with the chief of the Taliban police. And the message was, we want to look after you. We want to make sure you're safe. Tell us what you need. We want NGOs to feel safe. We want you to stay and deliver.
What is the level of need in Afghanistan right now, and what is able to be met by the few groups that are still on the ground there?
First of all, I believe that most of the NGOs who left will soon return. The UN has its air bridge up and running, and I'm expecting a lot of NGOs resuming their work in the weeks to come. But the needs are staggering. It is a catastrophe. Somebody say that it's on the brink of catastrophe. We are full head into it. More than 1 million children are at risk of dying this winter from starvation. 18 million people are in need of humanitarian assistance. The public sector is about to collapse. Who will pay the salaries for public teachers or health workers in clinics and hospitals? These are questions that need to be answered, and they need to be answered fast. The situation is dire in Afghanistan.
What are the most dire needs in terms of humanitarian relief for Afghanistan right now?
Even now, money doesn't help because the market is dwindling due to the failing crops. I mean, 40% of the crops is failing due to the drought. So there is not enough food in country. It needs to come either by airplanes or by land from neighboring countries. If food does not reach Afghanistan, people are going to starve to death and in high numbers. In addition, in a couple of months, the winter will come and there are minus degrees in Kabul and in the northern part of the country. People need shelter. People need blankets. People need winter clothes to themselves and to their children. They need firewood. They need winterization assistance, and they need it before the winter comes.
Astrid, you described the situation in Afghanistan as dire. What's an image that kind of lives with you in terms of what that dire situation really looks like?
Every time the snow comes in November, December, I travel out to the Kabul informal settlements because I then see children running around barefoot or in plastic slippers in slush, in frozen water and snow. People are living under a tarpaulin or with makeshift walls made out of cloth, etc. And it's a good reminder for me why I'm in this line of work and why I continue to work in Afghanistan despite the somewhat cumbersome situation.
I was going to ask, why are you staying put in Kabul?
It's my duty. It's my job. I was actually out of the country when Kabul fell, and I managed to get back. And I have no intention of leaving the Afghans behind. Afghanistan needs us more than ever.
Astrid Sletten is in Kabul. She's the country director for the Norwegian Refugee Council. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The small Baltic nation of Lithuania doesn't usually receive many asylum seekers. Last year, barely 100 crossed over the country's eastern border to apply for asylum. This summer, more than 4,000 have arrived. European leaders blame neighboring Belarus for orchestrating a refugee crisis in revenge for the EU slapping sanctions on the authoritarian leadership of Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko. But as Andrew Connolly reports from the Lithuanian-Belarusian border, the reality is more complex.
The little village of Videnia is in southeastern Lithuania, close to the border with Belarus. On a basketball court in a school building, Farah stares up at the hoops.
Sometimes when we are stressed, we come here to make ourselves busy.
But Farah says he didn't come here to play basketball. He came to escape Somalia.
For us, for me, I used to be an English teacher. I used to small children in Somalia. But there in my country, there is what you know, Islamic terrorism, called Al-Shabaab. They don't want to hear any person that teaching foreign language. So if they had, they will tell you that you are introducing Christianity. The only thing that they want to do there is Islamic religion only. So once they had that, they started to find me. Before they find me, I ran away.
Farah is hoping to be granted status as a refugee here in the European Union, but the Lithuanian government sees him as a political pawn because he entered the country from neighbouring Belarus. The Belarusian dictator, Alexander Lukashenko, has threatened to flood the EU with migrants and asylum seekers.
Because, amazingly, they're arriving with commercial air flights, with touristic visas. Later they're paying some few hundreds of euros or dollars to smugglers and they're transporting them to the borders.
Arnoldas Abramavičius is the Vice Interior Minister of Lithuania. He says Belarus is orchestrating a refugee crisis in his country. The government there, he says, is promoting entry to the EU through Belarusian travel agencies and smugglers.
They're crossing the border. They're losing all the identification documents and Belarusian guards directing them, facilitating, showing where is unprotected parts of Lithuanian border. And there's many video footages when they so accompanying them to the borders.
Several thousand migrants are now being detained near the border with Belarus. My request for access to one of those camps was denied, and this may be the reason why. That's from a video shot at a military facility where hundreds of single male asylum seekers are protesting their detention. Reports from these camps in Lithuania say conditions there are bleak and violence has broken out. But back in Videnia, at the former school building where migrants are living, the atmosphere is calmer.
And where is everybody from here?
Most of that we have Congolese, Togo, Guinea, Eritrea, Somali, South Sudanese,
Cameroon.
It's like different, we are mixed, different countries here, but we are all African.
Dozens of people sleep on camp beds crammed into classrooms. Aman Mahari is a 16-year-old boy who says he's fled military conscription in Eritrea. He tells me the lack of information from authorities here is frustrating.
You see us, everyone are here. You cannot go out, you cannot sit. We just asked for a freedom and we didn't have an answer. What will happen to us? What's our future? Why we are sitting here at this place?
Asylum seekers here also tell me that a recent visit by a Lithuanian member of parliament just made things worse. In a video, the parliamentarian can be heard angrily venting at some of the men.
My country is paying for you 30, 40 euros per day. We have pensioners in Lithuania who do not get such kind of money.
But the well of sympathy has not run dry in Lithuania. Ieva Čečelita is a project manager for the Catholic aid organisation Caritas. In a storeroom next to an imposing white church near the Belarusian border, she sorts through piles of bags full of donated clothes.
I'm a big patriot of my country, really. But sometimes I want to ask some questions. Because, you know, for us, for 3 million, it's not difficult to take care about 4,000. It's one school. No, maybe not one school, maybe two schools in Vilnius. Yes. What's happened?
The Lithuanian government has announced it will complete a wire fence on its border with Belarus next year. laws have been passed to allow mass detention, rapid processing of asylum claims, and expedited deportation agreements. Meanwhile, Farah, the young guy from Somalia, is far from sure what comes next for him. When I ask him about the political spat between Lithuania and Belarus and how he feels caught in the middle, here's what he tells me.
This country is doing because they say these people have been used by Belarus. No, we have not been used. Me, I came from my own, from Somalia to there. And this was the only way to pass. So I don't know the government of Belarus. I don't know this. I don't know. So sometimes when I read the news like this government is using, I become very stressful because that's not reality.
Farah says he simply saw a new opportunity to reach Europe at a moment when borders are becoming more and more closed. And now his reality is being caught up in the limbo of Europe's ongoing migration dilemma. For The World, I'm Andrew Connolly from Lithuania's border with Belarus.
Canadians go to the polls on Monday. The election was called by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in a bid to regain a governing majority. For the first time, all major parties have presented serious plans to address climate change. But their platforms reflect the difficulty of drawing down carbon-intensive activities in the oil-producing nation. Emma Jacobs has our story from Montreal.
Anne McCaig is a retiree living in Ashcroft, British Columbia. An unprecedented heat wave in June turned the spruce trees in her yard brown and had her seeking refuge in the basement. Then came the wildfires.
Like, we were surrounded all four sides by fires.
About an hour from her, Lytton, British Columbia, where she used to live and work as a teacher, broke Canada's all-time heat record 3 days in a row, reaching 121 degrees. On the fourth day, Lytton burned to the ground.
I didn't really wear N95s throughout the pandemic. I was wearing an N95 here in Ashcroft because it was that yellow, acrid smoke. I couldn't see 100 feet ahead of me.
McCaig has been volunteering for local Green Party candidates for a few years, but experts say extreme weather events have made climate policy a top priority for more Canadian voters.
I think the attention has grown. Polling is showing that climate is one of three, maybe four top-of-mind issues for Canadians.
Catherine Harrison is a professor of political science at the University of British Columbia, focused on environmental policy. Canada's Green Party hasn't got a lot of support, but Harrison says all the major political parties have proposed relatively ambitious climate policies for the first time this election cycle, even the Conservative Party, which draws a lot of support from oil-producing provinces.
The Conservatives have included some real policy, more regulation, but I'm very skeptical that they would follow through with the level of ambition that it would take to meet their own target.
The Conservatives' proposal is to cut emissions 30% by 2030, which isn't enough to meet Canada's commitments under the UN Climate Accord. Proposals from the other major parties would get there. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's Liberal Party has set a target of 40+%. The New Democrats, a smaller party, target 50%. The Greens, 60%. Climate advocate Seth Klein would like to see more ambition, but says the range of plans do show progress.
This debate has shifted to the point that every major party feels they need to present a platform that they hope people will find credible.
But change will be hard, practically and politically, for any party. Canada's oil and gas sector has made up about 5% of GDP in recent years. It's energy-intensive work. Just production, not the burning of the fuel, represents a quarter of Canada's carbon emissions. On the campaign trail this month, Prime Minister Trudeau talked about investing in helping oil-dependent regions transition.
We will continue to work with workers across the country in the construction sector, in the energy industry, to transition, to pivot, to improve the opportunities for them in their workplaces, but also for their kids and their communities.
Still, in the same remarks, Trudeau talked about the oil industry, like it's going to be around at least until 2050, even though that's when the Paris Agreement dictates global emissions need to be brought down to net zero. Supporters of Canada's oil industry argue that while oil demand continues, better the last barrels come from Canada, which tries to limit emissions from production, than somewhere else. Trudeau's government argues the proceeds will fund Canada's own clean energy transition. Again, environmental policy professor Catherine Harrison.
That's a kind of standing line that the liberals have used, I think it is becoming more difficult to say because global ambition is increasing and because Canada's own ambition is increasing.
Ambition will have to transcend any political party for Canada to reach targets set for dates like 2030 or 2050, because it's unlikely one politician or even one party will remain in charge that entire time. For the world, I'm Emma Jacobs in Montreal.
Got a wishbone drying on the windowsill in my kitchen.
Pop star Lorde's new album, Solar Power, dropped a few weeks ago, but now the New Zealand singer has released some extra tracks. She's taken 5 songs from the album and translated them into Maori, the indigenous language of New Zealand. The release comes during Maori Language Week. Lorde, who is not Maori, is receiving a wide range of reactions from the indigenous community. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Hemi Kelly was part of the team of Maori people Lorde consulted for the project. He teaches the Maori language at the Auckland University of Technology and says the new songs are more of a rendition of the originals rather than a direct translation.
So in Solar Power, one of the lines is like, I'm like a prettier Jesus, I think. Come on, come on, tell you my secrets, I'm kinda like a prettier Jesus. Now, if I was to translate that literally into Te Reo Māori, it just wouldn't have the same meaning or effect. So I went with something like, well, I'm like Hine Moana, who's the ocean maiden.
The first thing Kelly says he did was sit down with Lorde to get to know her and her intentions.
One of the big pushes in this whole movement is that the language be normalized so that it sits alongside English here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, in our society, and it's given the same recognition. And the intentions of Lorde aligned with those efforts.
The EP was created and guided by some of the most well-known Maori leaders, and all proceeds will go to organizations working to preserve New Zealand's indigenous wildlife and history. These collaborations are important to Erurera Kepa, a Maori communication specialist in Rotorua.
Although it might not seem a big thing, but actually is a really big thing because that's where sometimes a lot of issues happen is through the lack of consultation. So to hear our native tongue broadcast to a much wider audience than New Zealand, it's huge for our language.
Kepa says the album leaves him feeling proud. His favorite song is The Path, translated to Te Ara Tika. Though many listeners won't understand the Maori, Kepa hopes the songs are an introduction to the language.
Even simple greetings like kia ora, ka kite. Kia ora means hello, ka kite, goodbye. That is a journey to learn and acquire Te Reo Māori, but everyone needs a starting point.
But for many Maori people, Lorde singing in their language has brought up painful history.
Removal of the Maori language was used by colonizers to marginalize, isolate, oppress, disenfranchise Maori from being Maori.
Kiri Dell is in Ruatoria on New Zealand's eastern coast. She researches the economic development of Maori and other indigenous communities.
So whenever the Māori language is a topic, it is a sore one because of the pain that has been associated with its strategic removal by the colonizers of our indigenous communities.
When Dell heard Lorde's album, she says she personally didn't feel much because she doesn't look to people like Lorde to engage in her Māori identity. She turns to people like her mom, Hinetu Dell, a former teacher who grew up during a time when the language was even less accepted than it is now. For her part, Hinetu Dell hopes Lorde's songs rise to the top of the charts.
Anything that pushes the language to another level, it's good because it allows discussion. And whether it's good discussion or bad discussion, it doesn't matter. It's being discussed.
Kiri Dell agrees with her mom. Lorde's album will bring massive awareness to the language. But she's not sure how much that awareness is actually needed.
That's what I'm trying to interrogate. Do we need celebrity awareness for a language to survive?
At this stage, I don't believe that's true.
Revitalization efforts have been ongoing for decades. Today, only 20% of the Maori population and 3% of all Kiwis can speak it, according to a recent statement from the Maori Party. Maya Week, calling from Waiheke Island, says the language continues to face an uphill and often racist battle. As an Indigenous person, she sometimes feels defensive when non-Maori celebrities insert themselves into the conversation.
Because I fear that this person in a privileged position will come in, engage in our culture, and then leave.
Week stressed that she hopes Lord will continue to stand with Maori communities as they fight systemic racism across the board.
Don't let it be a one-time thing. Let this start a journey. Stand with us, uplift us, listen to us. Because as an Indigenous person, it's painful going through this continued colonization.
Kiri Dell echoes this and says supporting Maori communities has to go beyond supporting the language. From her point of view, Lord singing in Maori is not the main issue.
The issue is the allocation of limited resources, limited energy, or the expertise going in the direction of non-Maori.
As this conversation has unfolded online, many people have been highlighting their own favorite Maori musicians. Hinatu Dell generously gave me a private concert of a Maori song. She says the lyrics talk about cleansing your thoughts and body. Daughter Kiri fondly added,
"That's a real Maori pop song."
Yeah.
For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Joking aside, let's end today's show with a real Maori pop song that came out earlier this month, Tiaho Ihora, which means East Coast Moon. It's a duet between two of today's biggest contemporary Maori singers, award-winning musician Tama Waipara, singing here with Maisie Rika. New Maori pop song closes our show today. You can listen to more new music on our Spotify playlist, including other global hits from artists we've featured on the show. You can find a link to it on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow. Oh.